Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody to Season 1, Episode 5 of Rancho Notorious. My name is Dan Slevin, and here with me at Rancho Notorious, we usually say it's Kaylee Carruthers, but Kaylee had a slightly dodgy milkshake.
Really? Today.
It was a milkshake, yeah.
Oh dear.
That's to blame. So she didn't tell me where that milkshake came from.
I think that's important knowledge we should track down.
Yeah, we should. We'll put that in the show notes for the purposes of people avoiding said milkshake purveyor. But instead, we have this able substitute. So Doug from last week's show, Doug Dillerman, welcome. You're sitting in the Kaylee chair.
Thank you. And I grew up near Canada, so I feel pretty close to Kaylee in that respect.
It's fantastic. And the special guest that we always knew was coming... Sarah Watt from Sunday Star Times, film reviewer for Sunday Star Times. You also appear on TV3 and Morning Report periodically. Welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Hello, listeners.
It's a pleasure having you here. Look, this is just fantastic. It's always great to have friends and family here at the ranch. And today, on today's program, a little bit later on, I interview Weta Digital lead animator Dan Bassett about his work on the new Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Sarah's going to help us review that film as well. And Doug, too, you were at the same screening
I was
at.
In on that.
Yeah, yep. You can help in. And plus, Brendan Gleeson in Calvary, two films that, at least on the surface, couldn't be more different. On top of that, we'll have the usual glut of news, stats, and opinion. But before we get too far into it, Sarah... how long have you been at the Sunday Star Times, and what's that like as a place to ply your trade?
About 3.5 years as their chief film critic. Fantastic. Lately we've taken to increasing my word count by a couple hundred words. It's crazy. Well, it was, if I may be so bold, it was at the expense of my photograph and byline, but... who said print journalism, if wasn't dying, didn't know how to make another buck? So they said, give us a couple hundred more words because, you know, to be fair, we're now putting a bit more effort into having a slightly longer first review, primary review each week. So I get a bit more flexibility, a bit more rein to say more about the context of the film.
And as chief film reviewer, does that mean that you get to decide, like there's a team of you, right? And does that mean that you get to decide who does what?
I basically collude with my editor, James Crute. He's the entertainment editor, so, you know, I would collude with him on what we were going to do and what we weren't. But certainly I would think it fair to say that I get dibs on the films that I particularly want. I'm finding as I'm getting older that, you know, I see the trailer for Hercules and I think, you know, I've got a lot of time for Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and I know I've said that
Don't
in many
all?
A review.
For
no,
sure.
I genuinely have. But I just feel as though Hercules probably isn't one of the films that I'm going to give up one of my precious evenings for. And so I will focus my energies elsewhere.
Right, and you've got a day job now, and that means that sneaking off to daytime screenings, apart from days like today, are not always possible. So you do have to be a little bit more
I have to
careful.
Be more judicious. Yeah, absolutely I do. Yeah, that's right.
So there was a study published just the other day. I saw this in one of the trade websites, and there was a big debate that ensued as a result. The San Diego State University study that only 28% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes probably didn't take a year to do this study, I have to say. If somebody's doing a PhD, getting their PhD in this, they're probably slacking off the rest of the time, right? So it's not hard to do this count up. But anyway, only 28% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes are women, and in the business trade publications, only 10% of the reviewers for film in the US are women. Now, in New Zealand, it's slightly different. There are a few
Yeah.
Well, one, at least, apart from yourself.
Oh, no.
Who
Francesca
else?
Rudkin, Helene
True.
Wong,
yeah.
Kate Roger.
Oh, yeah,
Sarah
right.
McMullen. So actually
probably not
we're
a bad...
reasonably well represented, but we're still totally the minority. And it's interesting, you know, I see that theory sort of posited that it was because women don't like to tell people what to do. What a load of rubbish. I don't think that's it at all. You know, thank you for pulling up my soapbox. I will step upon it. I think it's largely to do with the fact that film criticism is, I mean, it goes without saying it's a male-dominated industry, but I think that the readership and the listenership and the viewership and whatnot is so predominantly male. There is a huge bias out there, not across the board. Obviously, I'm sitting here with two very right-thinking gentlemen of the trade, but I bet you that male film reviewers don't get trolled on news websites on, you know, on their film reviews for you're a woman and therefore you don't understand sci-fi and those kind of things, which have been hurled at me. And indignance just doesn't even come into it, you know, it doesn't even get to how I feel about that sort of thing. I just think it's a load of bollocks, really. But it's interesting because, you know, the same thing, isn't it, with like comedy generally. There's that myth that, well, women can't be funny. And so comedy is a predominantly male world and male industry. And I don't know, it's just how that is.
It seems to me that, first of all, it's a bloody hard road. Anyway, being a film reviewer anywhere, there's fewer positions, fewer paid positions. It's there are a lot more people doing it for the love rather than because it's a profession. In fact, I would advise anybody thinking of going into it as a profession to think again, really. It's the kind of thing that, you know, free movie tickets is about as good as it gets
yeah.
for a film reviewer, isn't it, really?
But to be fair, I mean, you actually hit the nail on the head. People don't get into film reviewing because they think it's any sort of profession or anything that they can carve a living out of. That's not it at all. And so I think if I have anything in common with my male peers, it's that at some stage in my life I went through a period of extreme nerdism about film and started to watch film much more intentionally. And out of that, because of the place I was in my life at the time, I started to write my thoughts about film. And one thing led to another, and I met the right people and became the film reviewer for the Sunday Star Times. But only after I had already done a stint of blogging and whatnot. Maybe it's just that women aren't as disposed to that kind of, I'm going to sit at home on a Friday night and watch 2-3 films back to back and then kind of get on the internet about it and read more articles about it and then get up in arms about it. Maybe that's all it is. Maybe women are off having a life and men are at home in the dark watching other people's lives. I don't know. But, you know, that's my theory.
Indeed. Well, this is the point in the show where normally we would go to right there. We would normally go to Kaylee and say, "Hey, Kaylee, what's in the mailbag?" But she's not here, so I'm going to have a bit of a hunt around for some feedback. And we have had a message from a regular listener to the show and to the other show that we used to do. So Caroline, she, on the basis of our review last week, went to see Ernest and Celestine and took her kids. So,
and did she have a thumbs up?
Well, this is what I'm just going to read it to you. Here we go. Ernest and Celestine is a beautiful and thought-provoking movie. The mistrust and behaviour between the bears and mice was a bit disturbing for me, not the kids though, and an interesting reflection of society. The 4-year-old lasted a while before needing to sit on my knee as some of the scary bits were a bit much for her. The 7-year-old loved it. Two words, delightfully artistic and thought-provoking. Oops, that'd be 3.5, sorry. We still haven't quite worked out whether we're going to actually do the two words or not. I think we probably will end up doing two words. But anyway, so there we go. Thank you very much, Caroline, for that. And if I have a bit of a hunt around and see what...
I'm so glad that people are going to see that because it's such a fantastic film. And it's perfect for the kids' holidays as well right now. So
yeah, exactly. And also, now, we threw out a challenge last week to listener Reese Pye.
Oh, did she take it up?
She took it up, and we are so grateful. And she is very, very...
what was the challenge?
The challenge was because the number one film in the UK last week was Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie.
Oh, God!
And we... We thought that somebody who a little bit closer to the source than us should tell us what this is going to be like. And she's very upset that perhaps her money might have contributed to, to it being the number one film in the UK again. But either way, here we have Reese Pie on Twitter, and she has... The best thing I can say about it is that I didn't find it as offensive as the slices of the television program I have seen, and it was only 96 minutes long. The stereotypes, it was like disappearing back into the 1970s. Sold to the earth market traders, token characters from ethnic minorities to poke fun.
Why did she go if she doesn't like the TV show?
Because we asked her to.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. Because when you're a reviewer, sometimes you have to see
things that you don't like.
You have to throw yourself on that grenade, don't you?
Are we talking about Transformers again?
Whoa.
Well, luckily, thank you very much, Reese Pie, for doing that. This film is going to get a New Zealand release, and no doubt the people in this room will have to go and see it for some reason. And look,
I get the ability to choose, yeah. And I've actually spoken to one of the co-reviewers who has said that they hope they don't have to do it. So there's one guy left, and so we'll see.
I'm reasonably sure that Lumiere is not really concerned about covering it.
Look, I have to say that I would be deeply disappointed if Lumiere doesn't actually expand its coverage to, because I'm sure there's an essay. I'm sure there's a long form. If there's not 2,500 words on Mrs. Brown's Boys to Movie, I would be
and
very...
And that's true, and there would be.
I think that's what interns are for.
So thank you very much. We'll have a much bigger mailbag next week. But just... One thing that showed up in my Twitter feed, and I do like to mention this person's reviews periodically as they show up, and that is former Prime Minister Helen Clark, now working at the United Nations in New York. Periodically, she'll go and see a movie and tweet about it. New Zealand film reviewer overseas. Films don't come much better than Ida, a fine Polish-Danish co-production not to be missed. So there you go, from former Prime Minister Helen Clark.
I'm with Helen on that one. Yeah. I think we all are.
Yeah, that's three of us. And it's just really great to see a movie that hasn't premiered at the film festival, that doesn't have a big name behind it, that's making the go-rounds in the art house and really finding a following outside of that.
Indeed. All right. Now, this is the part of the show where we find out what New Zealanders have been going to see. So the top five box office in New Zealand, and we'll throw the net a little bit wider as well. But I think, Doug, you have that in front of you.
I do, and Glorious Comic Sans right in front of me. And coming in at top five...
Don't make it seem like I typed it.
No, this is the MPDA who prepares it every week in Comic Sans. So it's their thoughtful contribution to us. Number five, down from last week at three, is 22 Jump Street. Do we share the grosses with people?
Well, if we think it's going to be the kind of thing that will stop traffic, yes.
Okay, well, I'll wait for the ones that I think do stop traffic. debuting at number four, Mr. Clint Eastwood's latest directorial effort, Jersey Boys. Number three, down from last week at number two, What We Do in the Shadows, which is still doing quite respectably in its third week. Mm. Debuting only at number two, interestingly, is How to Train Your Dragon, which opened bigger than the number one, actually, but only did about half the per-screen average of our number one, despite being on a...
But this is the weekend, is it?
Fewer screen.
This is the weekend, but it is school holidays. And so you know, so something and it opened earlier in Australia and just... It opened earlier than Transformers and absolutely caned it. Maybe that's the Australian school holidays being earlier than ours.
To be fair, it made $590,000, which isn't bad. But number one, apparently we're still going nuts for Transformers Age of Extinction, although it is down 53% from last week.
Yeah, it's not quite jumping off a cliff, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, but that's still $3.3 million in 2 weeks, which is pretty rarefied territory.
In the New Zealand context, definitely.
Yeah, the only other film in the top 20 that's actually exceeded that is X-Men Days of Future Past, which has been out for 7 weeks and is only at $3.68 million.
Wow. So all right.
I think that's pretty
telling. Vis-a-vis Transformers, if you're interested... We made a decision at the Sunday Star Times. We didn't have the space. We said we won't bother to review Transformers because no one could be there for it, and we would let it go because it is absolutely, and this you know, 3.3 million proves it is. It, the film will be seen by the people who want to see it regardless.
Well, but that's interesting, I think, from a Sunday Star Times point of view, in that, you know, that if you think about the New York Times in New York as being the paper of record, and how films will often open in New York just so they can get a New York Times review, which gets them, you know, a certain amount of kudos. And the New York Times still reviews absolutely everything. It must be pages and pages and pages of little documentaries that open only in New York. But Sunday Star Times doesn't consider itself to be to have to cover those things.
Oh, look, you nearly tricked us into saying we don't consider ourselves to be a paper of record, and I wouldn't say that at all. No, I don't mean that. I just mean, though, that when space is tight and choices have to be made, I think it is absolutely fair to say that Transformers crowd are going to go regardless of whether I say it's 2.5 stars or whatever. So, you know, I think that that is a fair choice to make.
Fair enough. In Australia, the top five straight in at number five, Jersey Boys. Clint Eastwood's film. 22 Jump Street at number four, down from two. Rio 2. Has just arrived in Australia, so that's at number three, 20th Century Fox. Also, How to Train Your Dragon, also another Fox film, and that's at number two. And Transformers, Age of Extinction, holding on to, straight in at number one in Australia, with $4.84 million Australian dollars in opening 4 days, which is it's not bad.
Oh, they'll be happy about that.
And Doug, you've got what have we got from you next? Have you
got
the UK
here? Yeah. And which I believe, as we discussed last week, includes Malta as well for some reason.
Yeah, bizarre.
Interestingly, number five, I haven't heard on any of the other lists, the debut of Tammy, which is the new Melissa McCarthy vehicle.
Yeah, and it has opened in the US, but presumably didn't. I'll have a look at my. You've got the US list, haven't you?
I don't have the US list.
Well, maybe I've got it.
Do you have it?
No.
Ooh. Well,
Over here.
Ooh.
And Tammy does not get into the top 10. No, I lied. I lied.
That's because women can't do comedy? Oh, wait, it's Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah. Anyway, no, Tammy was number two in the US.
Oh, okay. So Tammy's making a big splash overseas and will come here maybe. I haven't seen it actually on any coming soon list, so.
And for some reason people are really disappointed by it. Either disappointed by the box office or disappointed by the film itself. So who knows?
I've seen pretty middling reviews, but we'll keep our hopes up. Number four, How to Train Your Dragon 2. Number three, 22 Jump Street. Number two, The Fault in Our Stars, hanging in there for its third week. And number one is apparently Transformers hasn't opened in the UK, and I don't know if you can say they've been spared or not, because instead they have Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie.
Still going strong. You know, there's going to be two, three, and four of those. Just quickly run through the US. How to Train Your Dragon 2 at 5. Deliver Us from Evil, number 4. 22 Jump Street, number 3. Tammy at number 2. And Transformers Age of Extinction on a weekend gross of $37.1 million and a total of $175.4 after only a week and a half.
Did we ever establish that $100 million figure we were debating last week?
I was a bit busy to do the audit, actually. but these are all voluntarily supplied, these figures, from the distributors. And so my understanding is that Paramount massage the figures ever so slightly so that they could have that opening week of 100 million. It was like 99 point something or other, but they just...
I'd give them that.
Give them the benefit of the doubt, yeah. When he was here a few weeks ago, Graham Tuckett suggested that we actually throw the net a little bit wider and find out what's going on in some of the other territories. So here's the Finland top five for last weekend. Number five, Blended. Down from three. At number four, a new entrance, Begin Again.
Anyone? I've seen it.
What's that one?
That's Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo.
The folk music.
Director of Once, John Carney.
Right. Okay, Begin Again hasn't arrived here yet, so lucky old Finland. Maleficent down one place to number three. Transformers Age of Extinction. See, this is interesting. Drops to number two in its second week. And the number one film in Finland, How to Train Your Dragon 2, but interesting that, what's the population of Finland? Doug,
I'm not a population expert.
These really are fairly pitiful amounts of money. So the movie going audience in Finland, I mean, Finland's small place anyway.
It's also
right?
Summertime.
Oh, yeah, true. $195,000 US dollars for How to Train Your Dragon opening weekend. No, actually, it's actually week number four.
Mm.
So presumably that means it's getting bigger each week, that, you know, making its way to the top. Anyway, interesting old Finland, and no Finnish films in the top 20.
That was my reaction, is that that just sounds like it could have been anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. No Finnish films in the top 20, but interestingly, number 17, Johnny Toe's Drug War. At number 17.
Fantastic film.
Yeah. A film called Bamse och Tjuvstaden, which is, I had to look this up a little bit earlier on, and that is a Swedish kids animated film featuring the most popular Swedish kids book character. Other than that, no, it's A Million Ways to Die in the West, Edge of Tomorrow, Walking on... Oh, this one. Is Walking on Sunshine on anybody's release list for New Zealand? This
not
is,
that I know of.
This is another of those jukebox musicals. It's a European co-production jukebox musical, all full of music from the 80s. So, hence Walking on Sunshine, oh, Katrina dear. And the Wave Song. So, really not looking forward to that. So, much as I love all that music, I just think this is possibly a bridge too far for all of that. Anyway, we've been talking about, box office and... what?
So now...
Now it's time to actually talk about a real film.
Bites! Do not want war.
You know the scary thing about them? They don't need power. Lights, heat, nothing. That's their advantage. That's what makes them strong.
Caesar love humans more than apes.
So there we go, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I made a little joke on 9 to Noon this morning saying that I was hoping that it would be called Dawn from the Planet of the Apes and would have made a very different film. Zara, you did...
I went beyond the call of duty. I think let's just get that out there.
Exactly.
I paid to see this movie.
And what time of the morning was
9:30.
It?
9:30.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Opening, mind you, it is instructive, isn't it, to see who gets to go to a big blockbuster movie like that on at the very first screening on the very first
day.
It
was a special preview. It wasn't a special as in special people, but for some reason, I mean, it's got to be special at 9:30 at Sylvia Park, right?
Mm.
So yeah, 9:30 preview. There were 11 people in the cinema. They were all of the male persuasion. But for me, there were some fathers and sons there. And as the film unfolded, I thought to myself, God, this is a nice father-son film, because there pretty much aren't any women in it.
Well, she's sick for most of it, the one woman who's in it.
One woman.
No, Carrie Russell's around.
Yeah, well, one gets sick.
No, she's fixing the sick woman.
Yeah, I was going to say, gets sick and then one does the fixing. Yeah,
yeah. Right. But it did have some nice sort of father-son moments, didn't it? So I thought, well, that's nice.
Mm.
So what do you want to know?
Precy.
Well, right, a précis of
what's
the film.
What's it all about?
Then? Oh, I always struggle with these. Okay, so basically, don't ask me how many years on we are since James Franco was in it, but
it's
God,
funny.
I miss it.
Look, I actually said... really?
Yes.
Okay, so I got this wrong on the radio this morning and got a message on Facebook saying that...
Of course you did.
From Graham Tuckett saying that apparently one of the monkeys said it's been 10 winters.
Well, that no, I heard that actually.
Right.
It had been 10 winters,
and I had to chastise him for using the word monkey in a disrespectful
Simeons,
way.
I think is
so. You
the
had
word.
To correct his correction.
all right then. So 10 winters on from James Franco. Do you know I don't make a habit of re-watching the film from before, but this time I kind of wished that I had.
Right.
But I mean, look, it's not so difficult that you couldn't go see this film knowing absolutely nothing. I'll just get that out there. So all right then, 10 winters have passed, and what was it? 2 winters ago that they stopped seeing the humans. Well, there's that wonderful business. Okay, so at the beginning of the film, there's all the archive footage of...
It's nicely done, isn't it?
That it is actually really nicely done. And it packs a whole lot of exposition into the world has gone to hell because of what they call simian flu. And so the population has been not decimated. Let's not misuse that word, but I don't know. Well, they said up to 150 million people might have been killed. So... We then are in San Francisco. I loved the evocation of San Francisco. You know, vines all over the buildings and the bridge still functional but decrepit. So the humans are getting on with their own lives. not knowing that the apes have made their lives in the hills or over by the dam and are keeping to themselves and getting on with their own life.
They're building a little paradise, aren't they? They build a little paradise for themselves. And see, you were saying that you kind of wished that you'd seen the previous film.
Well, again.
Again. And here at this house, we have had an ongoing project over the last sort of 6 weeks or so to watch all of the Apes films again from the initial Charlton Heston one, because I wanted to be able to watch this one and get some references, you know. And this film owes a lot to Battle for the Planet of the Apes, which was the last cheapest, poorest performing, but actually quite
nice.
Was that
the Helena Bonham Carter one?
No, not that.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Wash my mouth out.
The Burton Wahlberg of which we do not speak. No, this one was, the Battle for the Planet of the Apes was the last of the Heston series without Heston. And so it was the Roddy McDowall ones, we should call them, the Roddy McDowall period, which again, the apes are living sort of undisturbed by human beings in a kind of Garden of Eden setting, and humans turn up and wreck things. As is our want.
That's right. And of course, that's exactly what happens in this instance here. And actually, so this whole sort of eye for an eye notion, yeah, the humans bumble their way in, commit an atrocity, a small atrocity, but one that nonetheless the apes have every right to get upset about, and suddenly retribution, revenge, eye for an eye has to start happening, actually is very credible, horribly, actually, horrifically credible, the way humankind carries on. And that is definitely a strength to the film. And then it just becomes kind of a, well, the humans can talk to the apes because the apes can talk. And so therefore it becomes a, well, you need to trust me. Well, I'll trust you. You should trust me. And I do trust you. And on it goes until, of course, other humans get in the way and bungle it up.
It's a source of great frustration. During the film, there's nothing that frustrates me in watching films when people who palpably can communicate with each other don't, and you know, like, and particularly when that sort of when that sort of stuff becomes ways to redirect the plot, or they become, you know, drivers for the narrative, and in
so who are you talking about in this instance who can't communicate?
All of them.
Like, no, but the apes can talk to one another because they do it sign language. But they all looks the same.
They can, but they don't. And
but
so
sometimes they do.
They do, but they don't effectively. If you know what I mean, it's like if you know when you're watching a film and you think, oh, if you two just sat down over a beer,
yeah.
And didn't have the need to actually have this conversation completed within the 35 seconds that the screenwriter is allotted for it. If you actually gave it the time to, like, the human hero and Caesar so obviously believe the same things and get on, and they've spent several nights together in the forest while they're negotiating the access to this dam that is so important. It's like, you'd think in that period of time, Caesar would understand slightly more about what's going on back at San Francisco home base, and he would understand a little bit more about where Caesar came from. But it all comes as such a... It's like, talk to each other at all?
I don't know how long you've been reviewing films and watching films,
Dan. It doesn't happen, does it?
But no, that's not the device, is it? So they've got to misunderstand. And
misunderstanding is so important. And you also get very clear misunderstandings between Caesar, played by Andy Serkis again, and Koba, who, if you've seen the film before, he had a minor role as a veteran, if you like, of the scientific experimentation community, and came out as a sort of battle-hardened lieutenant to Caesar, and that's where he shows up in this film. But you realise that actually the damage that was done to him psychologically means that he's one of those characters that will just never be able to trust.
You know, I mean, I'm not dark on this film, but I didn't love it to the extent that my male peers coming out of the film a few nights ago from a preview screening were raving. So that's why I thought, I'll pay $16 for this. It's bound to be amazing. I don't feel quite like they did, but I would say that Koba's character, when he points at his scars, and this is not a spoiler, because as you've said, we know that he's a vet, but when he points at his scars and says, this is human work, and they treated me really badly, I actually was quite grateful for that, because as the film went on for its 130 minutes, he was actually able to bring me back to, hold on just a second, they've treated the apes really badly, and I can somewhat exonerate his bad behaviour.
Totally, it was understandable,
is,
wasn't it?
As you say, completely scarred. And why should he suddenly go, oh, all right then, Jason Clarke, you look all right to me, mate. You've got integrity in your little blue eyes, we'll go for
not
it.
All not all apes, hashtag.
Yeah, not all humans are James Franco, are they? Let's be honest. And I just want to mention the fact that Koba is played by a different actor this time around, an actor who called Toby Kebbell, who an English actor who is I guess a character actor more than a lead, but it's a fantastic performance. And there's and when you know how these motion captured performances work. And you look at his there's a scene where he is discovered finding the cache of arms that the humans have in San Francisco, and you think, oh, how's he going to get out of this? And he does it in such a fantastically inventive and beautifully performed way.
I
just think that Toby Kebbell, like, everyone's talking about Circus and how amazing he is, but actually, you know, for somebody who's never done that performance capture stuff before, Toby Kebbell's just is fantastic. And his, it's like every hero needs somebody to play off, and Caesar needed somebody, a really, really good, strong protagonist and antagonist to play off.
Can I just speak to Andy Serkis? I started watching the film and I thought, I know it isn't, but that looks like Brad Pitt to me. He's acting like Brad Pitt would do it. And I had to very quickly do that, what you never do, but there were only 11 people in the cinema. Got my phone out and had a quick look on IMDb.
Just to make sure it wasn't.
Oh, yeah, of course it's Andy Serkis. And then I could relax for the rest of the film. But honestly, the whole way through, it looked like Brad's face acting to me. And I think it was and so we're talking about Caesar, terrific performance. I think you're absolutely right. If anything, and maybe this is because I'm a girl and I'm not so into it, but if anything, the anthropomorphizing of the apes, which was done so incredibly well, and I do appreciate that that's what a lot of people have responded to positively, was actually a little bit unnerving for me, because I think there's something in my mind going, but hold on a second, we're not supposed to think that they are human. I appreciate that they have been humanized through experience, but we're not supposed to believe they are human. But my goodness, I'm getting it from I'm feeling that they are human. Yeah. So hang on a second, aren't they meant to be apes?
There's an accelerated sort of development process going on here, particularly from particularly from those who were, I think, in the lab to begin with. So you notice that that Caesar and Koba use their hind legs much more. So they're basically much more upright, much more bipedal, and they're the horse riding ones. And those are the ones that have generated the power of speech. You know, whereas the apes that just got the one shot of gas at the pound aren't quite as developed.
But the other thing I think is also that the ape stories are also just so much more engrossing than the human stories. And so you wind up in this strange thing where you're relating to the apes, whereas you have Jason Clarke, who manages to not have more than one expression for most of the film. You have Carrie Russell, who just sort of follows him around and then stops following him around. And that's
Cody Smith-McPhee, who just mopes.
Yeah. Mm. And then the one who shoots an ape and then gets brought back to the apes for no obvious reason. Gary Oldman actually does an excellent job in a very limited amount of screen time. He's one of those actors I find that can go either way. But
when he's not chewing scenery, he can be pretty good. And he has a really interesting little scene where when the power comes back on and he gets to, and his iPad fires up and he gets to look at some photographs of the old days, and you think, he's looking at photographs of the old days. But he's actually, you know, like former special forces. It's all of these uniforms going past.
He sees a picture of his kids, and then he cries really well. But the problem is, I'm sitting there watching that going, far out, he's a good actor. And suddenly I'm thinking about how method is he, and I wonder how he got to that. Did he do the I imagine my cat dying and all that thing?
So you were, I'm guessing that you were.
So I was jolted out of the film, but I didn't.
Because he was too good for the rest of it, is that what you mean? Yeah. I think directorially, though, there's a lot to recommend in the film, and that's what the level that it worked for me on is. I feel like that Matt Reeves really showed what he could do with a camera. Michael Saracen, as well as the DP, would obviously have been involved. But just the perspectives, the view from the ground going up above, there's this strong sense of these compositions of him taking this sort of these magical element of these apes in these very quotidian sort of shots. And that created a sense of wonder that you don't often find for me. And even just the basics of just doing a quick or a slow dolly back with a hallway in front of you while a scene's taking place in 3D just creates this strong sense of space. And I think the fundamental story mostly works. I feel like it falls down more on little script details, which is why I'm excited that Matt Reeves is actually writing the next one, where he just directed this one from another script.
Well, I must admit that it wasn't until the very end that I realized that Matt Reeves had directed it, and because I thought that it was Rupert Wyatt back for another go round. And so, and my only memory of Matt Reeves was Cloverfield, which I really, really didn't like. So,
have you seen Let Me In?
Yes, I have. I have seen Let Me In, and that's the version of that story that I didn't fall asleep through. So, I guess I was worried just with Let Me In, and that, you know, like, where's the originality? You know, here's what's been buzzing around in my head for the last few weeks, really, and that is, if you think about Reeves and Gareth Evans, and which one's the Raid guy and which one's the Godzilla guy?
Edwards and Evans.
Yeah, exactly, right. The Welsh, all these Welsh directors, right? Mm-hmm. And Rupert Wyatt, the English one, and I would include Edgar Wright in this, and is thinking like, the great cinematic minds of my generation are making sequels and remakes and reboots.
And blockbusters.
And where, you know, Christopher Nolan at least seems to alternate his personal vision with his...
Edgar Wright hasn't done that, though.
He's been making his own sequels to his own films. I mean, but I also would include just genre pictures in that, you know. Like, those two Raid films are the most visually inventive, propulsive movies.
Yes, but narratively they're not clever.
No, they're not. But I watched that first one and thought, this is like the dance movie that I always wanted to watch. You know, like, I would love to see him do what Toa Fraser did with the ballet. You know, it's like, this guy knows how to shoot stuff, right? But I worry that all of that talent is being put into the service. I mean, we've got Rian Johnson going into the Star Wars universe, right? And so he is lost to us now for the next 6 years, right? Because he's going to be shooting or writing Star Wars films.
Imagine if he could write something for Star Wars that was narratively clever and complex. But do you think he'll get away with that?
No, probably not. But and this is the thing, is that I just feel like he's lost to us now. Mm-hmm. And it's like all the talent's being hoovered up by these by the giant franchises.
But it's their choice, of course, as well. And that's the thing. They've dreamed of these things. You get these directors who've talked about doing Star Wars since they were a kid, and it's like they're achieving their ambitions. Gareth Edwards apparently wanted to make a Star Wars movie. Now he is going to do one of the side spin-offs, and
I bet you $1 million though they don't get the free reign on it that they dreamed of when they were a kid.
Well, of course not. And that's the thing, is there all these larger budget things, because they're a line item on a giant corporation's, this movie has to come out and perform this, and this
and
is
it has
leveraged
to come
against
out this Christmas,
and it has to have somebody holding a Sony Vaio or a carton of Chinese milk, as is very embarrassing in Transformers Age of Extinction or whatever. Yeah. That they discover that actually that brings all of these. It'll be interesting in 8 to 10 years if they're back doing these really micro-budget films.
But what are we going to do in the meantime? It's like,
go to the Film Fest.
Go
There's
watch Ida, too.
Yeah. Go watch North
Ida
to the
Returns.
End of History.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, we're not doing two-word reviews yet, but we will bring them back at some point. I suspect we'll have to. I'm going to do a little survey. I'm going to do a little online survey so listeners can choose. But anyway, did you feel like you got $16 worth?
No, I didn't. Mm. I didn't. I thought it looked incredible, and I thought narratively it was meh.
So you're not hanging out for the next episode, because you know they've sowed the seeds.
No, I'm just not bothered.
What would it need for you?
Oh my god, I actually do quite enjoy a clever script, but we'll talk about that shortly in Calvary. Oh. But no, I have no idea what it would need for me. So move on.
Doug, $16 worth?
Well, considering that I spent $16 on Transformers, it seemed like masterpiece by comparison. So that's probably not the fairest thing. I enjoyed it more than Sarah, and I'm sort of in 3.5 stars territory. I don't think it quite lived up to the 5-star raves I heard going in. But photographically and as a big screen experience, if you're into those sorts of things,
yep,
then I'd recommend it as a trip to take.
Yep.
And on the subject of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, yesterday morning I was lucky enough to interrupt the holiday of Dan Barrett, one of the lead animators from Weta Digital, who worked very, very hard on the movie, and he told us a little bit about how the whole thing came together. Dan Barrett from Weta Digital, welcome to Rancho Notorious.
Thank you very much, Dan. Good to be talking to you.
Look, it's a pleasure having you on the show. You're a lead animator at Weta Digital, and you know, heavily involved in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which has involved a huge amount of Weta Digital resources over the last. I mean, how long? How long has Weta Digital been involved?
Well, I mean, I guess you know, the best part of a year we've been heavily involved, probably a little more actually, covering the live action shoot. But obviously, it's been with us for a while now because we did the first one, and so we've had a little practice and a little preparation for this one, which has been nice.
And how did you get involved in this line of work? Because it's an incredibly specialised set of skills and talents and experience.
Accidentally, really. I'd been to art school, and I worked with an artist a little bit, and then I worked for an artist in New Zealand called Neil Dawson for a while, and then kind of thought that I should maybe at the age of 28, thought I should perhaps, you know, look at doing something else. And I went to Christchurch Polytech, actually, and started looking at web design stuff. That was graphic design what I was looking at. And doing that, I was exposed to Flash animation, which was, you know, all the rage, you know, back then. Every website was Flash, and it was quite the thing. And I kind of fell a bit, and the tutor asked me if I'd ever seen, you know, 3D animation. I'd never even really conceived of it, never thought about it at all. And he took me to this lab where sort of 6 or 7 guys were sitting in there with copies of Maya and 3D Studio Max, and I knew instantly that was what I was going to do. And the course that I was in that day, pretty much, and started with and then about halfway through that, I sent a reel off to a little company in Wellington called Pick14, and
you're breaking up, I'm afraid, Dan. Have we still got you?
Sorry, are you asking him?
Yeah. We just seem to be fading in and out a wee bit. Are you in a?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm up in the Panel Islands, and the storm is still going on. It's been very panicky the last couple of days. So
the atmospherics. We're still not in perfect in perfect sort of digital communication.
No, not quite. Yeah, so that was pretty much it. I sort of stumbled into it, really, but as soon as I saw it, you know, everything I liked about everything I'd done in the past, you know, sort of entertaining people, making people laugh, you know, sort of performing, not being...
So let's just talk about, was it even a career then? Did people go, oh, you know, this is going to be a job, or were you looking at sort of carving a whole new profession for yourself?
Well, I think that what Peter Jackson has done in staying in New Zealand kind of gave, you know, us, you know, there was something that could be, that gave us a lot of encouragement back in those days. Things was being done, I guess, over Polytech, and so you know, I wasn't 100% confident that I was going to be all right, but it all opened up kind of very nicely for me, you know, over the years, and you know, in the early days, a friend called Trevor Brimer, who picked me up initially at Sector 14, you know, obviously gave me a big break, and then him again later on. I was working with Shane the Dragon as visual effects supervisor, and he hired me as animation director on that. That was also another big break for me, and then, you know, I haven't left Weta since. I had a couple of years at workshop working with Jane.
Right. So you specialise in faces, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, as animation supervisor, you kind of get anything that moves, really, isn't it?
Oh, I think we might have lost you.
Oh, can you hear me again?
I can hear you again now. Just want to just go back a little bit.
Sure. As I was saying, animation supervisor, which was my role on the film, you know, you've got anything that moves in the film, you're kind of responsible for. You know, you're responsible for the look of and the motion of. But facial animation is definitely, for me, it's the greatest challenge, I think, and therefore the most rewarding thing to be involved in. So I've certainly chosen projects over the years where, you know, that were heavy in facial animation because it's something that, you know, I think, you know, you can see us getting better with every film, and it's something you never really, it's such a complex thing that it's never perfect, never done, and so it's an exciting challenge every day, really.
So much of facial animation and this sort of CGI animation now is done with performance capture. Are you still interested in those projects which aren't necessarily performance capture, where there's, I guess, a lot more creative latitude for an animator?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's... there are great benefits to having a performer, you know, laying down the performance for you. In many ways, it doesn't change. I mean, as you sort of point out, but the major difference for the animators on apes would be that rather than them sitting down with a mirror or filming their own performances, you know, so in other words, being actors themselves, you had professional actors that, you know, lay the template down. I mean, lay the entire performance down, but it's still the same sort of challenges for us. There's no magic button that kind of makes a transfer, and, you know, there's plenty of times when you just don't have a face cam on, you just don't get any capture, so it's all just, you know, full keyframe. There's no kind of technology that helps us with every single shot. So, I mean, as I said, the challenges are the same, and it's just as rewarding. You just don't get so much of that, you know, as an animator, you don't get to be so much of an actor. but both, you know, both types of projects hold, you know, great appeal to me.
Before we watched Dawn of the Planet of the Apes last night, I rewatched Rise of the Planet of the Apes the night before, and a lot of the making of documentary snippets that were on that disc, and there was a lot of excitement manifest in those documentaries about new software and new technologies and things that they were able to do on Rise of the Planet of the Apes that they weren't able to, animators weren't ever able to do before. I remember there was one documentary where there was a considerable excitement about hair and sort of digital wig making that was, you know, that was kind of palpable. And that was 3 years ago. What's happened in the intervening 3 years that's either opened up new possibilities for you or made your life easier?
Well, I mean, in terms of animation, things are much the same. I'll just sort of briefly touch on that in a minute. With something like hair, obviously we've got, you know, a big R&D team at Weta, and they never stop work, you know. So I think that probably is one of the biggest leaps in this film in terms of look. You know, I think that the hair on the creatures is remarkable, and they've done incredible things with wet fur, damp fur, you know, all sorts of variations. You know, those have been some big leaps, you know, in terms of final look. For animation, I think, you know, we do have a tweak solver, so we're some of the facial stuff is coming through slightly differently, but it's much the same. I think that probably one of the biggest things, you know, I always say that a face puppet is never done, you know, and that's what we animate faces with, and it's such a complex thing that you can, the networks of shapes in those rigs are incredibly complex, and you could keep working on one of those things forever, really, you know, you could always be refining it. So in terms of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it was a great advantage to have, you know, a good deal of those face rigs already in our back pocket. You know, we'd already done a film, which we're all very pleased with. But to have the opportunity to go back in and look at those face rigs and refine them further, it just gives the animator a lot more range of tools and gives you the ability to, you know, be a lot more subtle about what you're doing. And also, of course, we had a new guy playing Cobra, for instance, and so we looked at Toby's face, we looked at Toby's performances, and then we were able to... you know, feather a little bit of his features into Cobra to try and make the job of translating his performance a little easier. Caesar was much the same, but again, I mean, he did have a lot of work done to him, you know, in terms of increasing the level of subtlety and detail that we were able to achieve. So, you know, in many ways, one of the things that helped us most was just, you know, having that practice and experience and being able to sort of build on top of that for Dawn.
There's it's incredibly difficult stuff to shoot as well, not just what you guys do afterwards. Do you get involved in that side of the process? Did you get to go to location and see what was happening at those early stages?
Not so much location stuff. Dan Lemon, the visual effects supervisor, supervised photography on the film for Weta. Eric Winquist was supervising the second unit. He's another visual effects supervisor. I got to travel to New Orleans and LA a couple of times for volume capture. So essentially pick up stuff in a motion capture volume with the director and actors, library stuff that we knew that we would need. You know, like when you're putting a armies into a film, you know there are a bunch of things that you're inevitably going to need. And when you've got all the actors in the same place, it's important that you try and get as much as you can. And at the very end, there another trip back to LA to do the final act, the tower punch up, the tower fight. Toby had broken his arm earlier in production and was not really able to do a lot of the more physical stuff. And so things were delayed somewhat. We went back at a later date and captured for that sequence.
There's been a lot of call online after Rise, and there will be again after Dawn, for a new Academy Awards performance category for a sort of collaborative performance. Is that something that you guys would love to see recognized? Do you feel like, or are you happy to be behind the scenes?
Well, it's a tricky one. I mean, at the moment, there's a category that sort of covers the work that we do, you know, the visual effects Oscar. I guess in order to have a category, you would want to ensure that you would have enough examples of that work in any given year to justify that category. I think that we're beginning to see that, and maybe at a later date that would be a good idea. I mean, the thing that I do like about what you just said is that it's very much a collaboration performances. In the case of CZ, as far as we're concerned, and as everybody should know, Andy's responsible for the authorship of that character, and of that performance. But there's an awful lot that goes on beyond that point to make sure that it translates in a way that people can kind of identify with. So, possibly. Maybe at a later date it would be a category that could come in.
The other day, because I was doing a lot of research, I watched all of the Apes movies over the last sort of 2 weeks, including going very back to the beginning, including the much maligned Burton Wahlberg remake, and I looked at the makeup effects on that and thought, wow, that was absolutely extraordinary technical achievement on the makeup effects. But of course, it arrived at the same time as Gollum. And of course, that's the last time that we'll ever see anything like that. At least I'm guessing. Can you see a time when even things like even a movie that needs to sort of transform an actor into an old version of themselves? We're still seeing makeup used for those sorts of performances, and not terribly effectively these days. I think is performance capture going to become the default, the norm for when you want an actor to be an older version of himself or something like that?
Yeah, I think inevitably we're going that way. Obviously, probably the great advantage with doing it physically is, lighting and shooting it is a lot easier, but things are getting so good now. I mean, you can see with the textures and shaders that we see on the faces of the apes in Dawn, it's getting so believable that I think we will go that way. I think that directors and producers enjoy the flexibility of being able to go in afterwards and, essentially make the shots whatever they want them to be, like they're not, tied down with what they have, in the can at the end of the day shooting. They can kind of, tweak to their heart's content. So I think there are great advantages from doing it. I don't think, as we see in Dawn, I don't think there's any reason for actors to feel threatened by this. Basically we're here to serve, if we love getting great performances that we can, translate. So I think it's certainly something that we'll see a lot more of in the future.
You're on a well-deserved break after the hard work that you've put into Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. What's next for you?
I'm heading back Yes, I'm actually going to head back today to sort of start slowly driving back down the North Island. I'm going to head back in next week, and we're in the throes of The Hobbit at the moment, so I'll go and see if I can help out there, you know. It's we've gone from one deadline to another, really, but so it's all hands to the pump, and I'll see if I can help out.
And Sarah, you're going to fill in to do some news for us.
If you booked your trip to New York just so you could see Bradley Cooper in The Elephant Man, you'll have to exchange those tickets, as opening night is now December 7th. The show is scheduled to close February 15 and plays at the Booth Theatre. It'll also star Patricia Clarkson and Alessandro Nivola.
So Bradley Cooper as The Elephant Man...
He can do it.
You reckon?
He's a fine actor.
Yeah, I'm yet to be convinced by that, but anyway, yeah, good.
But also, he's with Patricia Clarkson and Alessandro Nivola.
Yeah.
Don't know why I say him all Italian-like, because he's American as, but you know.
And he probably does the best British accent of any American actor that I've ever come across, Alessandro Nivola.
MacGyver is coming to New Zealand for the Armageddon Expo in October. Actor Richard Dean Anderson went on from there to bestride the Stargate universe like a colossus in the shows Stargate SG-1, Stargate Atlantis, and SGU Stargate Universe.
And, of course, NCIS Stargate and Stargate Special Victims Unit, which...
The second largest theatre chain in the US, AMC, has announced plans to replace 35% of all seats in its theatres with more comfortable 60-inch wide reclining seats. Whenever they have trialled the new seats, attendance has risen over 80%, even though capacity in each cinema has to drop to fit the wider seats in.
We could have told them this. New Zealand has been doing this for years, right? So we know that if you want people to come to the movies... then you got to make it comfortable for them. But isn't it interesting how no matter how much leg room you give people, people still want to put their feet up on the...
Can I just say, we were in a cinema not so long ago where I actually, and I'm not even joking, I get first world guilt about the amount of leg room in the Hoyts Wairau Park cinema because it is more than I need. I can put my feet out. You're right, I can't reach the seat in front of me without slumping down so low I can't see the screen. Not that I would be like that anyway. But... there is so much leg room that people could still traipse in front of me and not tread on my toes. And I actually feel guilt about that because it seems so wasteful and so frivolous.
Well, there's one thing that it just occurs to me, and that is that in the heyday of going to the flicks in New Zealand in the sort of 40s and 50s, where, like, if you've ever sat at the back few rows at the Paramount movie theatre in Wellington, you'll appreciate what people used to put up with. Because those rows haven't changed and the seats haven't changed, or they've changed the seats a little bit more upholstery, but basically the width is exactly the same. And you sit in those and then you imagine watching two features, a newsreel, a cartoon, and standing up for the national anthem. Mm-hmm. And you realise, but there's something about being so close to your fellow cinema goer, it becomes much more of a communal thing. I find that once you put the 3D glasses on and you realise that you, everyone's, there's distance between you and everybody else. Mm. It's much easier for everybody else to disappear, which in some ways is a good thing, but it also means that it's a less communal experience than it used to be.
True. And finally, in the best news all week, boutique distributors Cinema Guild have announced that they have picked up the rights to Tom Anderson's wonderful documentary, Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Okay, who wrote this news? this was just announced today, and I realised, you know, I don't know about you guys whether you agree with me on this, but... for the first 6 months of the year, you follow the film media and you know what's happening at Cannes and you get a sense of what's playing in various film festivals and what have you, and you think, oh, make a little mental note for what might happen at the New Zealand International Film Festival. Mm. And you've got a wish list, right? And you go, oh, I hope they bring that here. And then the film festival makes its announcement. And it's like Obi-Wan Kenobi going... these are not the droids you're looking for. And you just forget all of the things that you wanted to see and you go, oh, look at what we've got. Mm. This is great. But I realised that I was talking to you last week, Doug, about this. It's like the three things. There were three things that I really wanted to see in this film festival. The new HD remastered version of Los Angeles Plays Itself, which is just one of the best films ever made, their most intelligent documentaries ever made. And I really wanted to see, and it played at the film
2004 festival. I tried to buy tickets, it sold out on the day, and that's what I get for waiting.
Yeah,
I
learned my lesson. So here we go. So this thing exists, and it's been playing in repertory commercially in New York, right? So we know that it's available. And the Immigrant, which
the James Gray film,
Gray film, The Immigrant, which I saw a bit of when I was at Telluride in 2012. Did I ever mention that I was in Telluride in 2012?
Whenever I guess went to Cannes as well,
right? And James Gray actually came on stage to help present the award to Marion Cotillard, and of course she's the star of The Immigrant, and so we got to see like 5 minutes of this thing, and it looked like The Godfather Part Two. It was like, oh my god, this is so amazing. So that one hasn't shown up, and also the documentary about Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. So that none of those have shown up, and I think it's fascinating that, you know, I love the New Zealand International Film Festival. It's one of the highlights of my year, but it's good to take a step back every now and then and go, you know what? They don't tick every box.
Well, the Melbourne Film Festival's just dropped their schedule, and I've seen what's on it. And I went through, and there were 38 films that I wanted to see that weren't playing New Zealand, but there's also about 38 films playing New Zealand that I can't afford to see and don't have time to see. And so it's like, well, what would I do if those were playing? Also worth mentioning is that Cinema Guild's actually picked up quite a few Tom Anderson films.
It was just one on the list, yeah.
Red Hollywood, which he completed 20 years ago, they'll finally be giving his theatrical debut to, as well as Edward Muybridge, Zuprexographer, and one other I'm blanking on the name of. But he's a great essayist, and Cinema Guild's a great label that's put out Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, The Turin Horse, and heaps of art film, Norte, The End of History. So they have a pretty impeccable sense of taste, in
See,
my opinion.
I have a slightly dodgily pirated version of Los Angeles Plays Itself, which I, you know, will show to people periodically here, and just, you know, and I shouldn't admit to it because obviously piracy is a really, really bad thing.
Just don't tell anybody live on air.
No, I won't tell. No, I will not make that information public.
It's just between us.
But I would, you know, I would happily buy two copies of the new version of Los Angeles Plays Itself
to make up to atone for your sins.
Exactly.
And there's your segue.
Indeed. Let's get into the soul.
I was raped by a priest when I was 7 years old.
Why don't you make a formal complaint?
What good would it do?
The man's dead.
Things you hear in confession these days. The mess people make of their lives.
Could I have a word? I hope we don't get locked in here. We'll have to make love to keep warm.
Okay, Calvary. And I'm going to throw this one to you again, actually, Sarah, because off here, you've alluded to the fact that this is perhaps not your favourite film. And I'm really, really interested to know why that might be.
Do you want me to do a pre-see? Is that what you want, first of all?
Well, maybe I could do that.
Why don't you do that?
Well, all right, I'll do the summary. And that is that the great Irish actor Brendan Gleeson plays a small town parish priest on the west coast of Ireland, Sligo. And the film opens with a confession. And at that confession, we heard a little bit of it earlier on, one of his parishioners tells him that they were abused by a Catholic priest, and that because that Catholic priest is now dead, retribution cannot be taken against them. So he's going to take it against Brendan Gleeson instead, and he gives him a week to basically sort himself out. They will meet on the beach the following Sunday, and there the deed will be done. And Brendan Gleeson decides that it becomes a bit of a whodunit, or who'll do it for a while, where he wanders around the village trying to sort of work out who might have it in for him.
But let's be clear, if I may jump in.
Please.
Let's be clear, this is not... I think, and this is not a spoiler, but what's surprising, of course, is he's not trying to figure out who's going to do him in so that he can stop it happening. He has a real sense of, well, what'll be will be, doesn't he? He's very much like...
Up to a point. There's a moment where he tries to escape his fate, and he realizes before it's too late that actually he has to face up to certain he has to face up to certain things. Not for him personally, although I think that there's an element of his own personal history that he feels a need to atone for, but because he feels as if he has been chosen to take on the burden of from everybody.
I think that's what I'm getting at. I mean, to be fair, Brendan Gleeson, I think his performance is delightful through the whole film. I think it's really very, very beautiful, very sympathetic, and full of grace, which is very appropriate. And I think what's notable is that those who have seen... Now, I have to be really careful. Can I just jump in and say, this is John Michael McDonagh, who's the brother of Martin McDonagh. And Martin McDonagh, just so we're clear to everybody, did In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. And this brother did...
The Guard
and this film. But I still lump them all in together, because as far as I'm concerned, they've got the same mother. So, just
probably
to be clear...
as far as they're concerned, too.
Yeah, and also, Brendan Gleeson, obviously, is... he is in at least three of those four films. Anyway, so my point is, one may be tempted to think that this is about an avenging priest. Brendan Gleeson playing the In Bruges kind of like hired assassin type who's going to go out and find out who's got it in for him and be retributive. And I think what's beautiful about the film, if there's anything beautiful about it, is that Brendan Gleeson actually, as I say, is very graceful and almost resigned, although you're absolutely right, and we won't give it away narratively, but do you know what I mean? He doesn't like leap out there and start, you know, armoring up and scouring the village to find out who's going to do it.
It's almost as if this one piece of information provokes him to go and find out more about the people he shares his community with, and the more he learns about that community, the more he comes to learn that they need him, and yet they don't want him, and that fact alone is enough for him to decide the path that he's going to take.
That is so interesting that's what you got from the film. Because if I may be so bold, actually what I got from the film is that he already has a very strong sense of his parish. Because I remember that in some of the early scenes when he's talking to, and I don't know all my ecclesiastical, I don't know my terminology enough to know, the other dude who's across the desk, who's clearly superior to him, his boss, say, when he's telling him what had happened, that guy didn't really have a sense of who the people were in the parish and whatnot. And he was like, oh, yeah, she's with that chap and he's been doing this. And I felt that when he went around and did his rounds, like a good parish priest should, that he already had a strong sense of like connection and ownership with them. So that's interesting.
But something changes.
Hmm.
And there's a sense that... See... I hadn't read anything about this film before I went in.
No, neither.
And all I knew was The Guard, and I knew that The Guard was fitfully funny, but not very satisfying, and that Brendan Gleeson was the best thing in The Smurfs too, and so I was pretty bloody happy, you know, like I'll always go and see anything with
Gangs
him in
of
it.
New
you know?
York, everybody.
Yeah, totally. So, and so the first sort of 15, 20 minutes of the film, you think you're getting a sort of jolly Irish village characters, aren't they, you know, and there's a scene where one of the characters basically just, you know, tells him to bugger off, you know, and you think, oh, this has got a nasty, or this
I thought
is a
there
darker
was a nasty
side.
Edge through the whole thing.
Yeah, but that's what I think makes it so good.
Well, so apparently you, Mr. Slevin, have said that this is like the best film you've seen all year, or it's like right up there. Is that right?
This is. I think this is the best film that I have seen since This Must Be the Place.
So, what was so good about it?
What was so good about it was that for the first time ever on screen, I have, in fact, in any art form, I have seen somebody express the genuine levels of righteous anger at what happened in Ireland and elsewhere.
So you're talking about the victim, who to us, of course, as an audience, is anonymous until the end.
Well, no, I'm thinking about everybody. Everybody in the film is angry. Everybody in the film is angry. And they're angry at their politicians, their leaders. They're angry at the state of the economy. They're angry at the... at society. Everybody is angry at the way their lives have turned out, and at the one moment in anybody's life where the church should be able to provide some succor, that the church should be able to provide some sustenance, some guidance, the church has absolutely queered their own pitch so appallingly that nobody trusts them and nobody will take any notice of them. And it's like the church has let everybody down and they need them desperately.
Well, I see your anger and I raise you gratuitous shock value. And this is actually, nice segue, thanks Dan. The thing that put me against the film right from the get-go, and I stuck it out, thereafter there were terrific moments, but the thing that got my goat from that initial scene in the confessional box, and listeners should of course be reminded that, of course, in a confessional box, you don't know who the person is on the other side. So all we're hearing is their voice. But we do see Father, what's his name? Gleason. I actually felt as though we hear it in the trailer where he says, I was abused by a priest from the age of 6. And I believe then that he goes on to say something like, and I was bleeding from the arse from the age of 6. Now, not only did I feel personally like that was McDonough going into shock language territory to be ghastly, but there were members of my audience who tittered because it makes us uncomfortable and because it was shocking. And I thought, actually, if anything, you have gone too far, you have become gratuitous, and there and after, all he does, this is just my view, is roll out this litany of characters from the village who are all horrible, with the exception of the French widow, the daughter, and Father, what's his name. Yeah. Everyone was ghastly.
They are ghastly, but they are all damaged. They were not born ghastly.
Well, I'm of that belief, absolutely, but they were horrible characters.
They were, but they were all... something was absent in their lives, and they were filling that absence with alcohol or drugs or sex I actually felt that this was one of the most profoundly moral films that I have ever seen.
Really?
Yeah. I thought that this was absolutely about right and wrong. This was, and you know, like that, you thought that was gratuitous. I thought that every other film that's dealt with that same subject has, by not being gratuitous,
right,
has tiptoed around it.
Yeah, sure.
And you know, I haven't cried at the moment a film fades to black and credits start. You know, like I can cry during a film, I can cry at moments during a film. You know, but to be in the hands of a director who then, in the final scene, can give you what you need as a profound message of spiritual and human uplift after all that you've been through, and then fade to black. I just dissolved at that point. That was just like, and that very moment.
I think it's beautiful, and this is not, I'm not being patronizing. I genuinely think it's beautiful that you felt that way about the film, because for me, when I say the nastiness, I don't even mean the discomfort. I didn't find it a discomforting film. If anything, I just found it gratuitously nasty in a lot of places. That undermined that for me. So actually, until someone reminded me the other day of the final scene, and I went, oh yeah, that was a really nice touch. I see what he did there. That was beautiful. And it's interesting hearing your interpretation of it now brings it to me in a completely different way, but that was not my experience of it at all.
And I don't believe that it was necessarily shared by everybody in the audience that I was with either, because as Karen and I sat there in stunned silence, wishing that the lights hadn't come up quite so early they did, we could hear people around us going, and this was a Friday night audience, and people had expected to see The Guard too and what have you, and they're sitting around there going, well, that was a bit bleak, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's very interesting you say that. I think people will be expecting to see The Guard too. Yeah. And so I wonder how much McDonough actually intended it to resonate the way that it did with you, or whether
he knows exactly what he was doing, and I really feel that this is a film that's going to only grow in terms of its reputation.
But I think it's going to be misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be misunderstood by the Garders, the In Bruges, the Seven Psychopaths.
Well, see, I quite like Seven Psychopaths. I thought that was a very spiritual
film. I thought that was a disgraceful film. You can go online at www.linalamont.wordpress.com and read my rebuke of that film. But that's so interesting that you feel that way about Calvary. And, I mean, I think personally that McDonagh is a wordsmith. I think he is a lyricist. And I think the beautiful moments for me were things like Father, what's his name, saying to the altar boy, I do not underestimate the depths of your Machiavellian chicanery, and the sorts of things that you don't expect ordinary people to say. And that's the charm in it. And because we watch that and we are disarmed by that charm and we laugh, I then think it just, I don't know, it's awkward in that tonal.
I think it's tonally mixed. It is tonally awkward, definitely. But I think that if there wasn't the humour in it, then the anger would be unwatchable.
Mm.
But it's the anger that I really appreciated, and the anger that I watch so many films where people feel this need to be kind of even-handed, or they feel this need to have balance, and this is like, no, bugger it. These people were monsters.
Have you seen the Magdalene Sisters, just out of curiosity?
No, I haven't.
I think you'd love it because it's the same.
That's Peter Mullen, isn't it?
It's Peter Mullen with a complete broadside again. I mean, it's a different issue, but it's a
similar issue.
And it's similarly unsparing, perhaps, without the humor you speak of. I haven't seen Calvary, so that's all I can
get. Yeah, all I can tell you is that when Calvary comes out, it's going to get a place. I'm going to build a little shrine to it.
Good in this for house. You.
It's going to get a shelf by itself.
Good for you.
This has been Rancho Notorious episode number 5. If you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you will find a way to communicate with us via email. We've had a comment or two on the website. That's always good value. We are live in the iTunes store. There are iPhone and Android apps, which we will make clear that you can find. You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast, where we'll be tweeting incessantly about things that we think are interesting, and we do drop we support our friends. And we were tweeting just earlier on this morning about the Wellington premiere of Jake, and Doug, you can and Sarah, you can perhaps tell us a little bit about this. We'll be posting this on Friday morning, which is still time for people to get their tickets for.
Yeah,
tomorrow
hopefully
night.
Because it'll be on Friday night, 8:30 at the Paramount Cinema, and we'll be having a Q&A with myself and the other producers and actor Leighton Cardinaux, who plays the role of Jake, and it'll be hosted by Jonathan King, the director of Black Sheep Under the Mountain and the forthcoming Reality. So that should be great fun, and hopefully you can get to that. And if not, we'll be screening at the Paramount for a while after that as well. But tomorrow night's when
all
the action happens. Yeah. So make it if you can.
Cool. Next week on the show, How to Train Your Dragon 2, I expect. And I was looking at the list, actually. It's not very promising. We might do Jersey Boys. And we will have special guest reviewer, New Zealand actor John Lee, with us live here at Rancho Notorious. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto. Random Films, Claire Quaray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad and the Ugly by Los Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to play you out with some more music. Here's 60s king of easy listening, Roger Whittaker, and his big hit from 1970, New World in the Morning, from the movie Calvary. Thanks very much to Sarah. It's been a pleasure having you here at Rancho Notorious.
Always a pleasure, never a chore.
And Doug, great having you back. Thanks for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
We're off to have some dinner. Thanks for listening. That's Good Night from me, Dan Slevin.
Everybody talks about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning, so they say. Now I myself don't talk about a new world in the morning. New world in the morning, that's today. And I can feel a new tomorrow coming on. And I don't know why about a new
I met a man who had a dream he'd had since he was 20. I met that man when he was 81.